You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
And Heidi High, Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
How are you, Lionel?
Very well, thank you. Yeah, just been on a camping weekend, but not in chalets. We were in a tent.
Altitude tent?
Not an altitude tent either, I don't think. Just a regular tent.
You didn't do a Victor Campenaerts and deprive yourself of oxygen?
No, we just went camping for the weekend.
So what was the purpose?
Just leisure, Daniel. You know, enjoyment.
Really?
Family time together, all.
Not forced confinement? No. Was the tent from Decathlon?
It actually was from Decathlon, yes.
Good.
The tent was from Decathlon. Quite a lot of equipment came from Decathlon in one bulk delivery a couple of weeks ago.
In my rich tradition of doing, I don't really do promotion, do I? I do promote Decathlon occasionally, unsolicited, on this podcast. But I was thinking about this the other day that I was going to promote something because I tried the old Science in Sport gear the other day, the old menthol, where they kindly sent us some menthol powder drink.
And gels, Daniel.
First sports drink since I used to buy that. Since I used to buy Isostar in French supermarkets. Does that still exist? I had the old Science in Sport menthol. It's quite a remarkable sensation, the cooling menthol sensation after you've had some. I thought, I rate it.
Yeah, it's been very, very hot here. And I did a big bike ride on Saturday, so it helped me get through that. It cooled me off when I needed it most. But you're going off camping tomorrow, aren't you, Daniel? Or, you know, off on your travels after, 4 or 5 months confined to London?
Shan't be camping, Rich. I'm going to the Dauphiné over the next few days. Hoping that everything will, go smoothly as far as travel is concerned. Hoping, you know, we won't fall foul of the quarantine restrictions and so forth, between the Dauphiné and the Tour. But looking forward to it. It's a very concentrated route. Now, isn't it? It's down to 5 days and there's a lot of hills. It was going to be a mountainous Dauphiné anyway, but now it's even hillier. Fantastic start list. Bit of a rematch after the Tour de l'Ain. Jumbo-Visma, Ineos. Well, they sort of slugged it out, didn't they, at the Tour de l'Ain, and it's a rematch of the Dauphiné.
Well, there's a lot to look forward to. It does feel like the Dauphiné is a very important race. I mean, it's always quite important, but this year especially, it's the first ASO race post-lockdown and a real kind of rehearsal in lots of senses, from a racing point of view, from an organizational point of view, ahead of the Tour de France, because the news in France hasn't been great over the last few days with regards to coronavirus. So we kind of will be keeping a very close eye on that. But there has been a ton of racing and so many talking points, we should probably get straight to it. Can you give us a news roundup, please, Lionel?
I can indeed, Richard. Yes, Wout van Aert of Jumbo-Visma completed an Italian double, adding Milan-San Remo to the Strada Bianca that he won last weekend. He out-sprinted the defending champion Julian Alaphilippe after a hot, hard edition of the race on a very different, more inland course that saw a lot of the sprinters burned off before the finish. A few days before that, Arno Demar, the Milan-San Remo winner a few years ago, took Milano-Torino.
Neighbour of mine here.
Is he? Have you been out training with him yet? Well, he's been busy, obviously.
I've been checking out some of his routes on Strava. Rudy Barbier, the Israel Startup Nation sprinter, is also from a village very close to me, only about 10 kilometres away.
Oh, I can see you getting a little coffee stop group going there.
I mean, I know why this area produces good sprinters. It's pan flat or gently rolling, which is nice.
Well, the Milano-Torino race was a very different spectacle without the Superga climb, wasn't it? Earlier in the week, the Tour of Poland was marred by a terrible crash at the finish of Stage 1 in Katowice. Dylan Groenewegen of Jumbo-Visma squeezed Fabio Jakobsen of De Koenig Quickstep close to the barriers, and the Dutch champion crashed through those barriers, which gave way pretty alarmingly, and Jakobsen was left with some serious injuries. He has had surgery and was in a coma, but has come out of that coma and is starting his recovery, and apparently has not suffered any brain or spinal injuries, but his injuries are nevertheless serious. Groenewegen was disqualified from the race and has been suspended by his team pending the ruling of the UCI's disciplinary commission. He also has a broken collarbone, so wouldn't have been racing anyway. But we'll talk more about that crash and the notoriously fast downhill finish in Katowice a little bit later on. It was all the more poignant and upsetting, really, because it was the first anniversary of Bjørg Lambrek's death in the same race, although, of course, in very different circumstances. The Tour of Poland went on. Mads Pedersen got his first victory in the rainbow jersey the following day. Richard Carapaz of Team Ineos looked very impressive, taking stage three, but Remco Evenepoel took it to another level, blowing everyone away on stage four, attacking, well, 50 kilometres, 100 kilometres, 200 kilometres from the finish to seal an emphatic overall victory and keep his 100% record in stage races going for the year. Davide Ballerini rounded off the bittersweet week for De Koenig's Quick Step by winning the final stage. They took the race overall with Evenepoel, of course, but I think their thoughts were still with their teammate Jakobsen. Over in France, in a series of mountainous races which is heading us towards the Tour de France. First of all, a bit of a correction. Richard, last week we squeezed in an update on Chris Froome and Egan Bernal at La Route d'Occitanie and had speculated about the cause of Froome losing 5 minutes on the day that Bernal won. Turns out he was apparently playing the teammate role and had been working very hard and riding very well earlier in the stage. But lost 5 minutes, and well, we didn't know the cause, did we? So, you know, we just made it up.
Well, we were going by the results. I watched it the following day. I mean, it wasn't easy to follow that race. It was clear, yeah, Froome did quite a good job. Well, we'll talk about that, won't we, a bit later on, because that was a theme at the Tour de l'Ain as well.
Bernal, of course, saw out victory there. Romain Bardet crashed out, but he is set to be on the start line in the Dauphiné, which starts on Wednesday. Then it was over to Mont Ventoux, where Alexander Vlasov, who had been third behind Bernal and Sivakov at the La Route d'Occitanie, he won on Mont Ventoux ahead of Richie Porte and Guillaume Martin. And then came the Tour de l'Ain, which was won by Primoz Roglic ahead of Bernal and Nairo Quintana. Impressive backup from Jumbo-Visma with Steven Kruiswijk and George Bennett also well up there overall. Richard, you made the point on Twitter about the Tour de France looking like it's going to be a race between reds and yellows. And I've just got images of some kind of pub pool competition. The reds against the yellows, Bradley Wiggins sitting in the corner with a pint of snake bite saying, oh, I won all this in 2012.
And then Pogacar's the black ball that's potted at the end, eh?
Who knows? We'll find out a little bit more about everybody's form heading towards the Tour de France in the Dauphiné this week, of course.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thanks very much to iWalker, our title sponsor. Very grateful to them for their continuing support, and they'll be supporting us through the Tour de France that's upcoming and then the Giro, of course. iWalker, if you want to have a look at iWalker, go to iwalker.co.uk. They've got nearly 4,500 reviews on Trustpilot and an overall rating of excellent. 90% of reviewers give them 5 stars for excellent, 7% give 4 stars for great. And many of those reviews praise the customer service, and in particular the fact that iWalker, they speak to real people. iWalker do ask customers for reviews, whether positive or negative, and they typically respond to negative reviews within 2 days. A bit like the Cycling Podcast, that, isn't it, Lionel? That's your job, to respond to any negative reviews, sometimes in public. Sometimes you just throw your Zoom recorder at the wall or out the window. But you're our customer-facing rep, aren't you?
Well, if anyone emails us or contacts us, either with praise or a complaint, I do try to reply to everyone who gets in touch. Yeah, if somebody's
At some length. Often.
Sometimes, if somebody has a detailed complaint, I may send a detailed explanation or reasoning back. I mean, I'm not in an attempt to, you know, necessarily change somebody's mind, but in an attempt to, you know, shed light on a situation or put our perspective. But yeah, if anyone wants to email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. I won't be replying to any emails during the Tour de France, of course, because I'll be on the road. And but in late September, I'll get back to everybody.
Yes. You do indeed. You do a great job. Listen, Milan Sanremo, I'm sure we were glued to it. Did it feel odd being in August? In some ways it did, and in some ways it didn't, because there was a sort of, for all that it was a new course, there's such a familiarity to the pattern, I suppose, the rhythm of the race. We knew that it was going to come down to the Poggio, and it, you know, that everything else was preamble in a sense, wasn't it? And that felt very, very familiar in terms of how the race was won. I just saw a picture of Julian Alaphilippe and his attack on the Poggio with Wout van Aert sort of straining to get on terms. And it does look as if Alaphilippe was in the 53 by 13. He was in the big ring and almost the smallest sprocket at the back. So, you know, it's not an insignificant climb, the Poggio. The riders make it look not that significant, but it's quite tough. And I think that just tells us just exactly how hard Alaphilippe was going after 300 kilometres or 300 plus kilometres. It was a familiar but a great addition with a fantastic finish. Did you enjoy it, Daniel?
Yes, Rich. I mean, as ever, it was it was a game of fine, very, very fine, almost invisible to the naked eye margins. You know, everything that a rider does from kilometre zero to, you know, kilometre 299 in this case sort of matters. We've heard that and we've talked about that many times before. You know, Alaphilippe's puncture, Imperia, before the Cipressa, who knows what role that might have played.
Something that happened to him last year, wasn't it, as well? That
no, he stopped for a pee.
Oh, that's right. Yes, it was, wasn't it? But he had that chase back on, and it was almost as if history was repeating itself, wasn't it?
I think that pee was a sort of Balkamolima approach, though, wasn't it? The kind of get your adrenaline pumping.
But it was, as ever, I suppose. I think someone at the weekend coined the term the aggregation of marginal pains, Milan Sanremo.
That was Edward Pickering, just to credit him, because that was a good line. Yeah, I enjoyed that.
So every tiny extra effort that a rider has to make, they pay for at the end. And it's, you know, it's really fascinating to see this sort of wearing down process and to see how threadbare the group is when they get over the Poggio and they come to sprint for the win. And it really is a sort of a muted sprint compared to, well, the sprints we used to see Milan Sanremo at the end of the 90s, for example, when people were sort of getting really tired of the formula of Milan Sanremo, that it did come down to a sprint more often than not, and you had guys like Eric Zabel winning multiple editions in a row. You know, the riders come in now and they look a very visibly sort of tired and bedraggled kind of group, even though it is the sprinters, or a lot of sprinters who are still there. And, you know, it's interesting as well just to take note of the fact that for each of the last, I think, 13 or 14 editions, Milan Sanremo has had a first-time winner. There isn't anyone in the peloton at the moment who has won multiple editions of Milan Sanremo, which I think, you know, tells you something about how difficult it is to master. How many, again, imponderables, variables there are to master that we don't necessarily see or appreciate. And, you know, that was the case again. Just on Alaphilippe, you know, a week ago, he was, I don't know whether he was sandbagging or he was certainly talking down his form before Strade Bianche, suggesting, the way he was talking, he was suggesting it was going to be weeks before he was going to be in his best form. And then to be the most powerful, the most explosive rider on the Poggio was quite remarkable, really. And it just shows that if there is a rider in the peloton who is suited to Milan Sanremo and suited to that finale, it is without doubt Julian Alaphilippe.
If it's going to be weeks before he's in good form, then we should look out for him at the Tour Down Under, I guess. It was, I mean, yeah, very, very impressive. And Wout van Aert obviously did what he had to do going over the Poggio. Coming down, you know, Alaphilippe had a bit of an advantage, and perhaps not enough, but I thought his descent was quite erratic. He did seem preoccupied by Van Aert chasing him rather than, you know, he maybe just felt like he didn't have enough of a lead to really commit to it. But it looked to me like he was half descending as quickly as he could and half waiting for Van Aert to catch him up.
His coach, so his cousin, said that he was erratic because he wasn't sort of lucid at the top. He was, he'd gone too deep, and again, that's maybe due to the fact that he's not quite in top form yet. But he needed Van Aert, didn't he? In the end, I don't think he was going very far on his own. And again, you know, Van Aert arrived just at the right moment, and you know, had one of them, or had Van Aert hesitated for a second to come through, and when he did catch Alaphilippe, then they would have been caught. And any sort of moment's hesitation. There was a moment where it looked as though Alaphilippe wasn't going to come through and that was going to doom them. But because Van Aert was going so well, had so much left in the tank, he managed to push through. And he was the perfect companion at that point for Alaphilippe, wasn't he? There wouldn't have been many riders who could have taken that two-man group to the finish from that point, from the other end of the, or the other side of the Poggio.
It was a thrilling race in the final kilometre, wasn't it? The two of them, they looked pretty confident that they knew it was between them. They weren't going to get caught by the bunch behind. But I do wonder, had there been more sprinters in that bunch, or and sprinters with a teammate or, you know, two, a tall ask, really, given that the team sizes were small, only six riders. But the number of sprinters that had already been burned off did take the sting out of the sprint a little bit. You know, it was close, but they never really looked like they were going to get on terms. But you do wonder if that group had, you know, Caleb Ewan, Fernando Gaviria, Nasser Buhani, Elia Viviani, Sam Bennett or Alexander Kristoff in it, all going full bore across the road, whether they would have survived. I did feel, you know, I really enjoyed the course. And I you know, Daniel, somebody asked you on Twitter whether this could be the future of Milan-San Remo, not necessarily being held in August, but being held on a course that follows this hillier inland route rather than sort of, you know, arrowing down to the coast and then the following the flat and just taking in the little cappy. Clearly, the toll added up, because over the Cipressa and Poggio, the purer of the sprinters were, you know, dropped one by one, really, and kind of ruled out of contention. And I feel if they did tweak the route to this degree, I think the balance of the race, one of the things that we've all talked about enjoying, is that it could be won by, you know, a Vincenzo Nibali one year and perhaps a Fernando Gaviria or Caleb Ewan the next. That balance would possibly swing too far the other way. I mean, the sprinters who were up there, Matthews, Sagan, even Nizzolo, you know, they're more the kind of the hardier end of the sprinters rather than the pure speed merchants, really, weren't they?
It's difficult to pass what was the heat and what was the route. True. You know, there's no doubt that there was more selection on the Cipressa, and the attacks went earlier. The attacks went very early on the Poggio. Gianni Moscon attacked right at the foot of the Poggio. Usually there is a spot of three quarters of the way up the Poggio where the attacks always go, and not much has happened on the Poggio up until that point. This year it was completely different. I mean, I thought the new route was a nice change, very picturesque. I thought for the regions, the Tamaro Valley, that the race went through from sort of Alessandria to the coast, I thought it was a great sort of fillip for that region from a maybe touristic point of view, showing off a region of Italy that, even to be honest, Italians don't even know that well. There was a nice line in Gilles Simon's piece in L'Equipe, the first sort of paragraph of his piece, pointing out how Milan-San Remo is this kind of paradox, that it goes from, so places you associate with sort of hard work, grunt work, the industrial valleys and Milan, that, you know, the centre of Italian industry, and it ends in a place which you associate with sort of leisure, recreation and holiday, and the race does the opposite. The race starts off in a very leisurely sort of recreational fashion, you know, it explodes into life, you know, sort of alongside, in this case, the beachfront, where, you know, as we'd heard in the weeks leading up to the race, well, that San Remo were very worried about it sort of interfering with the tourist traffic there. But I think whether they keep the route that we saw on Saturday will depend on whatever lingering tension, ill feeling is there after all these sort of discussions that went on about whether the race was or wasn't going to take the coast road, the traditional coast road. I think there were some noses put out of joint in those conversations, and it may be that they do decide that they'd rather take the race to somewhere where it has been welcomed.
Just on the course, I read a piece on Velo News about Matthew Jorgensen, a young American rider who was 17th, 21 years old, and Movistar's best finisher. But he had 315 kilometres, 7 hours and 45 minutes on his device after the race, including the neutralised bit at the start. So, I mean...
Well, the official route was 305 and the neutral was 10K. So, I mean, technically that's outside of the UCI regulation for a one-day race, isn't it? So, obviously, in these circumstances, you know, just getting the race on was priority, wasn't it? But whether that's... You know, they were able to do it after months of doing an hour or so on Zwift.
I think there has to be a place for a sort of ultra distance race somewhere in the World Tour calendar, an ultra distance classic. And you know, the Milan San Remo is not extraordinarily hilly. That is its USB. Its USP. Its length. And you talk about lockdown napalm. We saw the sort of move towards and the desire for, the lust for, the thirst for very long distance rides on the part of pros and amateurs. I mean, we saw some incredible rides, people doing 400 kilometer rides, 450 kilometer rides, off-road, on-road, and there's definitely a thirst for that, I think.
Come back, Paris-Brest-Paris, eh? That was 1,200 kilometers. I had a Paris-Brest the other day, the cake. Delicious.
With the cream, how much cream was in it?
A lot.
A Paris-Brest-Paris is two Paris-Brest, one on top of the other.
Oh,
and
right.
Then you squish them down and force them into the mouth. Just on the touristic aspect, even Wout van Aert didn't have time to stop for an ice cream on the, you know, between the Cipressa or the Poggio. But I mean, he was impressive, wasn't he? And what a week. Strada Bianca first, and then he was third in Milano-Torino, and then winning Milan-San Remo. I mean, that's an impressive week by anyone's standards. And next up, the Dauphiné, where he did so well last year, and the Tour de France. I mean, for all the talk about, you know, Mathieu van der Poel, Remco Evenepoel and Wout van Aert, I mean, you know, van der Poel is the one currently, you know, not reaching the heights. The other two are, they are proving any of the sceptics who may have said wait and see at some point. I don't know who would have said this, but some people would have said wait and see. But Wout van Aert's a real deal, isn't he? I mean, he could win anything.
Did you notice old Pog matter-of-factly finishing 12th in his first 300-kilometre San Remo at the age of 12 or however old he is?
Well, yeah, I mean, he was quite visible on the Pog AO, and yeah, he sort of left a little bit too late, just caught a position maybe. I mean, it was Nibali and Kwiatkowski were closest to getting on to Alaphilippe and Van Aert, and I think Pog was a bit too far back at that point, but he certainly showed his strength. Word from Michael Matthews as well. I mean, that was his first race since Paris-Nice. He hadn't done any of the other races, and to finish third, pretty impressive. Peter Sagan again continuing his incredible run in that race, but yet again no win for him.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Well, that said, PK interrupting this week's episode to remind me to tell you that it is sponsored by our friends at Beer 52. Now we're coming to the end of summer, it says here in my briefing note, so that it doesn't actually feel like that. But perfect time for a barbecue or even a spot of camping, eh, Lionel?
Absolutely, Richard. Yeah, I very much enjoyed my weekend of camping, and I took a few of my Beer 52 beers with me in a cool box. The cool box was working overtime, really, coping with very hot temperatures in the day, but fortunately did its job, and the lagers were lovely and cold. After my daughter had gone to bed, I sat around the campfire as the sun set and enjoyed a couple of cans of lager. They were very nice. One of my favourites is I've talked about before, the Bohemian Pilsner, which I had during the Giro when I'd made a pizza. Went very well with pizza. It also went very well with a barbecue. So, yeah, a really lovely evening.
Well, I can just see you strumming your guitar, drinking your Bohemian lager around a campfire, Lionel.
It's not an image many people would conjure up when they think of me, but you know, I'm a surprising person.
You are. Well, Beer 52 are offering 8 craft beers sourced and curated from the best breweries on the planet for free. All you need to do is go to beer52.com/cycle and you pay £5.95 to cover the postage, but the beer is free. Beer 52 is the world's most popular craft beer discovery club with over 150,000 members. who they send a brand new case to every month. Each month's case has a different theme. Past themes have included beer from New Zealand, South Africa, Korea, and all over the USA and Europe, including our favourite Belgian beers. So again, if you want to take advantage of that offer, go to beer52.com/cycle to get your first case of 8 beers for £5.95. That's beer52, the number 5, the number 2.com/cycle. So that was Milan Sanremo, but our attention was drawn also by the Tour de l'Ain, which is not usually the case. It's not a big race, but it attracted... well, you had a great tweet about this, Daniel. What was it you said? It was like booking the local pub band and having
something
Live
like
Aid.
That, Rich. Yeah, I'm not sure you quite did it full justice there, but, you know, definitely some of my finest work.
It's available to check at freeboss on twitter.com. But yeah, I mean, it was a tantalizing showdown, and it did sort of live up to that. I think certainly Jumbo Visma came out on top. Roglic was a very convincing winner. Egan Bernal looked sort of vulnerable. He was isolated more than he would have perhaps liked to be. He had two Tour de France winners in his team riding in support of him, Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas. And as you said earlier, Lionel, Jumbo-Visma were really impressive. And I was kind of puzzled on the final stage. Team Ineos, with first of all Thomas and then Andre Amador and Chris Froome, they rode the sort of way they would ride if they were defending the jersey at the Tour de France, and they didn't have the jersey. It was Jumbo-Visma had the jersey, and I couldn't really understand why Ineos were burning through their riders like that when clearly their riders weren't, for whatever reason, weren't capable of sustaining their efforts all the way to the finish. That was going to leave Bernal isolated and alone, and Bernal clearly wasn't on the best day. I was just puzzled at how they rode and why they didn't leave that job.
I wonder whether
Visma.
They were practicing, you know, maybe they were trying to replicate having the jersey at the Tour de France and were using the Tour de l'Ain as a warm-up race rather than actually trying to win it. I mean, I'm sure they were.
Well,
of course.
That's what it is. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't matter in the grand scheme
of
things.
So as a result of that, do we just take down a notch, the importance of Roglic's win, or do we look at this as two really strong teams that are going to be, over the next week or so, continuing to improve? And we really have got a proper head-to-head battle, not just between individuals, but between teams in store. I mean, you know, Richard, you did, I've already sort of talked about your yellows versus reds. You can chuck Nairo Quintana in his red and black Arkea Samsic jersey. Quite difficult to tell apart from the Team Ineos jerseys. Maybe that will change when they are in the Ineos Grenadiers jersey. I'm not sure. But, Team Jumbo-Visma, if we go back to that Friends of the Podcast special you made, 18, 19 months ago now, Rich, we called it Chasing Sky because they had a project to try and challenge Sky in Grand Tours. And when you look at the lineup that they've assembled and the way that they're racing at the moment, it looks like they are getting very close, and we could have a fantastic head-to-head battle. And then the old adage, that something that you say quite often, Richard, that it doesn't matter if you've got the strongest team, if you haven't got the strongest individual. Well, maybe we'll see a slightly more nuanced battle between the two teams, especially when the leadership in Team Ineos may or may not be a matter of some debate. It's going to, well, it's certainly done exactly what we want, which is to whet the appetite for first the Dauphiné and then the Tour de France. But I'm as always, reluctant to draw huge conclusions from a 4-day stage race where the depth of, you know, there weren't too many. It was the Jumbo-Visma and Ineos show, really, with a bit of Quintana in there. It wasn't a full-on, mini Tour de France quite yet.
There's a lot we don't know, isn't there, chaps? I mean, when you look at a race like the Tour de l'Ain, and as we've looked at the Dauphiné in the past, you always feel there's a bit of a danger of riders, and we've seen in the past riders going too deep and getting sort of dragged into, almost their egos getting dragged into hand-to-hand combat, you know, and in this case, it looked as though, and, you know, this is a purely sort of subjective visual impression, but it looked as though Jumbo-Visma were relishing the fight, were relishing, going up against Ineos, and was that to the detriment? Was that at the expense of, I'm sure they've all got kind of prescribed training programs, and you know, might be down to the sort of wattages they're supposed to be producing on certain climbs. Was it to the detriment of, you know, the programs they're supposed to be following, and were Ineos, on the other hand, really sticking rigorously to a plan which is a more sort of physiological rather than a competitive plan? You know, we don't know. It's sort of black box. So, you know, where are they in their respective plans and build-ups to the tour? I mean, if you look at what they've been doing in training, there was a long training camp, altitude training camp, that Jumbo-Visma did in Tignes in the French Alps a couple of weeks ago, and they did some huge days there. They did a couple of days that were over, well over 5,000 metres of climbing, and there aren't any stages of the Tour de France that are going to climb that much. I mean, just looking again, I'm loath to really draw any firm conclusions from it, but looking at what Ineos were doing, you know, they weren't doing such big days, but who knows, you know, what sort of efforts they were doing on those particular days. And, you know, we also imagine there's a lot that the teams will not want to necessarily put out there about, you know, either in interviews or on Strava or so on and so forth, about exactly what they're doing in training. So, you know, we don't know really where they are respectively. And then the other aspect to it with Ineos is you've got this situation, particularly with Froome, where we think he's fighting for his place in the Tour de France. And, you know, how much is that affecting how he's riding and how other members of the team are riding? I'm not sure. Whereas Jumbo-Visma are completely at the other end of the spectrum. We've known their tour team. I mean, they've brought George Bennett in, but we've known their tour team pretty much for 6 or 7 months.
I mean, I think a lot of interest was in seeing Froome and Dumoulin race for the first time in over a year, both having had serious injuries and illness also in the case of Dumoulin. So it was a chance to see, you know, what they look like on these pretty tough climbs. And the signs were pretty positive for both. And I think with those two in particular, the margin for improvement, even in just a few weeks between now and the Tour, is probably quite high. And I think Froome's had a really good week or so, because, you know, riding in the way that he was riding in Occitanie and in the Tour de l'Ain will only do him the world of good in terms of improving his condition. So it's a sort of, you know, a double header, or a, you know, two boxes ticked for him. He's improving his condition, he's getting fitter, he's also demonstrating to the team that he's prepared to ride in that way, to you know, put himself in the service of Egan Bernal, and, you know, sending out those signs to the team that he's prepared to do that. Now, it is only Occitanie and Tour de l'Ain, but he certainly needed to do that, I think, after the last few months, when, if you'll remember, when Bernal gave an interview a couple of months ago in which he said that he expected the team to ride in support of him at the Tour, Froome was not happy at all and wanted the team Ineos, to put out a statement clarifying that, you know, he as a four-time winner would also potentially be the team leader. And this is really what paved the way to his departure at the end of this year. So I think he had a lot to prove in these races, not just in terms of his physical condition, but in terms of his willingness to play that.
And he's probably
role.
Done that, hasn't he? And so now the fantasy scenario is that on the opening weekend of the Tour de France, he goes full gas over the Col de Turini and puts everyone on the back foot and forces Jumbo-Visma to chase and upsets the Ineos apple cart. It's going to be fantastic.
Well, all bets are off. All bets are off once we get to the Tour, aren't they?
You'd like
really?
To think so. Yeah, you'd like to think so. And I mean, again, you know, we don't know. I mean, Dumoulin was obviously second fizzle to Roglic in the Tour de l'Ain, but he has pedigree as well. I was looking up, I mean, if you look at the number of active Grand Tour champions there are in the peloton, there are 11, four of whom ride for Ineos and two ride for Jumbo-Visma. The others obviously are Nibali, Quintana, Valverde, Aru and Simon Yates. I mean, you know, this is kind of the clash of the Grand Tour teams now, isn't it? Ineos obviously a lot more established than Jumbo-Visma, but as I say, they have quietly and methodically and step by step assembled a lineup and a methodology that is the closest we've seen to anyone likely to challenge Team Ineos, I think.
Yeah, and my fear, if I was an Ineos rider, if I was Thomas Bernal or Froome, would be that Rog has never had anything like as strong a team as this in any of his previous Grand Tours. You know, he won the Vuelta last year, and they rode well and were strong, and George Bennett was strong, but there were times when, you know, he really had to pull something out on his own. Based on what we've seen the last couple of weeks, or what we saw at the weekend at the Tour de l'Ain, he's going to be really well supported. My presumption at this point is that he is going to be their leader, and you know, they're not going in with Kreiswijk, Dumoulin and Roglic and sort of saying we'll let the road decide, you know, we'll see who's strong. Is I think that Roglic at this point is a notch above the rest.
And then it's going to be a game of, you know, who goes first, who does the early running, who gets the jersey, who wants the jersey, who wants to do that work. Will it be a case of the yellows saying to the reds, no, after you, and looking back? And would that open up opportunities for somebody else? You know, Pog.
And imagine a scenario, though, where you've got a, you know, the early break on a mountain stage has Geraint Thomas and Stephen Kreiswijk, or Tom Dumoulin and Chris Froome. And that means that the two strongest teams in the race are not going to chase, and you could end up with a scenario where one of those guys does end up in a really strong position, and his team is obviously going to defend that position at that point. So, you know, it could be looking at quite an open race potentially.
Or Ineos start chasing down Chris Froome.
Yeah.
Oh, it's going to be great.
Any more intel about the selection of the team, Buff? L'Equipe and La Gazzetta this morning, they've put out two different lists of six names that they think have already been given the nod by Dave Brailsford.
Where's the conflict? I mean, I a few weeks ago I read out my long list and short list.
L'Equipe has Theo Gegenhardt in there, definitely. La Gazzetta doesn't. Luke Rowe is not a certainty according to L'Equipe. I was under the impression, I think La Gazzetta is under the impression that he is.
I mean, somebody who will be a certainty is Jonathan Castroviejo, who was probably man of the match at the Tour de l'Ain. He rode outstandingly well, didn't he? And he's pretty versatile too. Dylan van Baarle and Luke Rowe are similar, you know, in terms of their strengths. Luke Rowe has been a road captain. Of course, he didn't make it to Paris last year, did he? He and Tony Martin were disqualified for fighting. You would think Luke Rowe would be a certainty, but, you know, in an eight-man team with three potential leaders and with Dylan van Baarle, a very similar kind of rider, it might be more difficult. I don't know, but
I'm just thinking back to past occasions when there have been two nominal leaders and maybe tension, or the suggestion of tension in teams. And I'm thinking back to Astana in 2009 with Armstrong and Contador, and there the issue of who was sort of the last domestique to be picked was very contentious, and it was, I can't remember whether it was Noval left out in the end. But I'm just wondering with Ineos whether in those sort of maybes, there is anyone, or there are riders who are seen as more Bernal guys or more Froome and Thomas guys.
Well, that's certainly Castroviejo is a Bernal guy, I think.
Just lastly, what did you make of Nairo Quintana, who was third at the Tour de l'Ain? But I was a little bit disappointed with him on Mont Ventoux, in the Mont Ventoux Dénivelé Challenge, where he was eighth. Good race, though. I know you two poured some cold water on my enjoyment of the Mont Ventoux
Landeira
last year. Yeah, I think so.
I think it's got a terrible name, but I think it's a really good race.
I did.
Yeah, I thought it was entertaining, certainly. And, you know, Pierre Latour was doing his Thomas Vauclair impression at the front at one point. Guillaume Martin looked pretty good. Richie Port, good result for him, second. Fabio Aru is returning to something like the Fabio Aru of old. And Quintana was there in eighth place. I was expecting a lot more from him there, but he came, well, he was in the thick of things in the Tour de l'Ain, wasn't he? Didn't look out of place amongst the Jumbo and Ineos riders. And a word for Alexander Vlasov as well, the Russian champion who won Mont Ventoux. He's apparently going to be in Astana's team for the Giro, I think.
Just on Quintana, Nairo Man, Napalmer on Mont Ventoux, I think the feeling was that he was still, well, he's still getting over the crash that he had in Colombia just before he came back to Europe. And also, I don't think he intended to really test himself on Mont Ventoux. I think he was always sort of building up to the Tour de l'Ain and the Dauphiné. I mean, that's certainly what he said afterwards, that he was fairly satisfied after the Dauphiné. But, you know, the Tour de l'Ain, he was sort of true to himself, wasn't he? It was the sort of knight or man we've seen over the last few years. We don't expect him to be very aggressive, but he's generally able to follow the best riders in the peloton. I think the school of thought, the idea that he's become a real threat again has receded a little bit just watching those races. I mean, it might change again. He might light things up at the Dauphiné, but when you see the power that certainly Jumbo Visma have, I mean, it's quite difficult to imagine on a tour course where there is going to be so many sort of GC days, and I think there's going to be significant action that will happen, significant things that will occur on stages that aren't necessarily earmarked as the big mountain stages. There are other medium mountain stages where, especially with the potential for multiple leaders in Jumbo Visma, Ineos and other teams as well, where they'll send their sort of second captain down the road. I don't think that's necessarily the kind of racing that will be conducive to a Quintana victory or success.
Barguil could sneak into one of those
whimsical flaneur. What about Superman?
Well, I was going to ask about Superman. What he's a shadow of his former self. What's happened?
Got his cape caught up in the phone box, trying to change out of his business suit.
Cape caught in the spokes, I think.
Miguel Angel Lopez. I mean,
12th at Ventoux.
Yeah, and didn't ride at the Tour de l'Ain, but we'll be doing the Dauphiné. We'll see this week.
Just returning briefly, chaps, to the Team Ineos team, because I don't think we should probably run through the names. Bernal, obviously, Geraint Thomas, Kwiatkowski, Pavel Sivakov, Luke Rowe, Castrovieco, Van Baarle. That's Ciro at Gazeta's prediction, with the last spot to be decided between Chris Froome, Teo Gegenhardt and Andre Amador. Now, some people have suggested Amador will go to the Giro in support of Richard Carapaz. But I don't know about that. I mean, you could potentially have Froome and Teo Gegenhardt and no Luke Rowe. And on a race like this year's Tour, which is so hilly, perhaps that would make sense. So Luke Rowe and Van Baarle can often be there quite late on in the climbs as well.
And L'Equipe also put Eddie Dunbar's name in the mix.
Really?
Yeah. As an outsider, they said. I'm not sure about that, but Kwiatkowski, are we sure about Kwiatkowski? They're both L'Equipe and La Gazzetta have got him in there.
I'm quite surprised at that, only because he's been riding a different programme and not, you know, part of that Tour team that's been training in Tenerife and all the rest of it. And I think on previous performances though at the Tour, where he's ridden very well as a team rider, I'm sure that would earn him the credit to make the team. But yeah, it's a difficult decision to make. Who would you pick, Daniel?
I'm not sure. I'm just thinking that, you know, we've talked a lot in recent years and with eight-man teams the importance of these sort of multi-tool, multi-function riders, and Ineos have excelled in that department. You know, guys like Dylan Van Baarle and Luke Rowe, who on a good day can do the first few kilometres on on the final climb of a mountain stage even at times. And I wonder about, that's one thing I do wonder about Jumbo-Visma. Their riders are more sort of specialists, it looks to me, and they're more pigeonholed. And I think because of that, Wout van Aert will be worth his weight in gold, because he will be good on most terrains, I think. They've really got climbers and rouleurs in Jumbo-Visma, with the exception of Wout van Aert, who is a bit more of an all-rounder.
Well, on the subject of Team Ineos and their selection dilemma for the Tour de France, I spoke to Gabriel Rache, the sports director who has stepped into the shoes of Nicolas Portal, who, of course, tragically died earlier this year. We'll hear from Rache next week on the responsibility of replacing Portal as the team's lead sports director of the Tour. But on the eve of the Dauphiné, I asked him what he had learned from Occitanie and the Tour de l'Ain.
For us, we got some really positive answers from some riders, and we kind of expect others to step up during this period, really, into the Tour. I think it's pretty clear that we saw how strong Jumbo-Visma was in Tour de l'Ain, and I think they clearly done their homework really well, and they're going to be difficult to beat in the Tour.
We knew that they were strong. Was the way that they they rode in the Tour de l'Ain, did it surprise you at all, or was it just pretty much what you expected?
I think there were, in general, more of them that was strong than maybe we thought. We didn't have our full lineup there in Tour de l'Ain. We missed a couple of guys, and some of our key riders, they're on their way up, progressing. They're already ready, the Jumbo Visma guys. But also we have to be, I think it's dangerous to start a war off against them, you know, because there are a lot of other good riders as well. And if we play that game, then people like Pogacar and Vlasov and Quintana, you can just sit and watch the first 2 weeks and then wait until we exhausted by each other. So we have to race our race, I think, and do everything right.
When it comes to picking the team, are you quite involved in that selection process?
Yes, I am. It's very difficult.
Well, there's been a lot of speculation. I mean, how close are you, or is it really, you know, will the main decisions be made after the Dauphiné?
Yeah, we still have some questions. We need still some answers on some riders, and I think after Dauphiné we'll do the final selection. Yeah.
What plays into that? Are you really looking at, you know, covering as many positions as possible? You know, you've got people like Dylan Van Baarle, Luke Rowe, who are similar kinds of riders. Or is it the sort of eight best riders, or is it the eight best riders in the positions that you need to fill?
It's more the eight best riders in the positions we need to fill, yeah, definitely. We need climbers, supporters, we need riders for the rolling terrain who also can climb. We need riders for echelons, we need riders for hectic finals, you know, so that's all part of the process, all part of the selection.
Do you know when a final decision will be made, or are you not really putting that pressure on yourselves?
No. I think after Dauphiné, we'll make, maybe during Dauphiné or the last days in Dauphiné, we know more. I think there's no real rush now at the moment.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks to Science and Sport for their long-standing support of the Cycling Podcast. Well, we heard Daniel's endorsement earlier on for the Turbo Plus range, that is, the menthol gels and drinks. I've been using that a lot as well. Very good indeed. In fact, I've just put in an order for a whole load of new Science and Sport stuff using the discount code SISCP25. SISCP25 for 25% off at scienceandsport.com. And keep your questions coming in for James Morton, the nutritionist, who is a world-renowned expert on sports nutrition. If you have any questions about your own or about the pros' nutrition, email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, and we'll put your questions to James and play his responses in future episodes of the Cycling Podcast. Now, before we get on to the tour of Poland and probably quite a lot of conversation about the terrible crash there, let's hear from our audio diarist, Larry Warbass.
Hey guys, so yeah, now it's the Monday after San Remo. Spent a nice week in Italy doing Strade Bianche, Milano Torino, and San Remo. And yeah, it was good, really good to get back racing. Yeah, the races went decent for us. We missed just a teeny bit to be there and, you know, like the top 10 and everything. But still, it was a really nice week with the team. I think we rode really well together. Yeah, we just missed that little bit last part for the result, which, to be honest, I think has a lot to do with like the heat. I think a lot of us probably haven't really been too adapted to that. And I think sometimes that can take some time. And, you know, we didn't do exactly a whole lot of anything special to prepare for that. For me in Sanremo, my job was to, you know, help Ollie as much as possible and to try to bring him into the bottom of Poggio in the first 10 wheels. I told him that I was going to try to bring him in first wheel. Unfortunately, I missed by about like 200 or 300 meters. So yeah, we were on the front and I exploded about 200 meters from the bottom. So so yeah, really close to being first, but he was in the first 10-15 and that was the goal of the team. So I was really happy that I could be there in a critical moment after, you know, helping most of the day. So yeah, that was good because got caught out just before Chipresa with a few guys. We were caught behind a crash, and about five of us came back to the bunch because we were probably 20 seconds off the back of the group at the bottom. So yeah, the legs are good, and yeah, hopefully, really looking forward to Lombardia now. Yeah, next weekend I should have we'll have a little more of a free roll in Lombardia, which will be nice as well. So I can hopefully try to play my own hand a bit in the final, which I'm really looking forward to because last year I was pretty good there. I was in the front group going into Chiviglio, but just didn't have legs on Chiviglio. So I'm hoping, another year, a little more experience that, this time I'll be there. So I'd really like to make it over Chiviglio in the front group. We will see what happens there. Beyond that, just everything else in the cycling world, I think looking at Tour of Poland, it was pretty crazy to see Remco obliterate everyone. You know, I think everyone knew that he's really good, but now he's just showing that he really is like another level. So, you know, you don't see too often in cycling anymore that people can attack from 50K out and win solo on like the queen stage. You know, that's pretty sweet. So that was a pretty impressive win and pretty impressive riding there. But yeah, I guess the thing that everyone's talking about is Jakobsen's crash, and that was really horrible to see. Yeah, it's a tough thing there. I think one, like we were talking about, or like a lot of people are talking about, is it looks like the barriers weren't exactly up to snuff. So that's one big problem. Two, I've done that finish numerous times in Tour of Poland, and it is pretty dangerous. I mean, the sprint's at like 80K an hour or something absolutely insane. But I would say that this was the first time there was really, really such a horrible crash. You know, okay, it is the fault of Groenewegen. He definitely closed the door when there was no opening. So, you know, it's like he shouldn't have moved over like that. But I'm 100% sure that it was not his intention to make Jakobsen crash. You know, nobody in their right mind would have that intention. You know, can we put it all on him? I wouldn't say that we could. You know, it's like people do that all the time in sprinting. It's super dangerous being a sprinter and being up there in the sprints. It's incredibly dangerous. It's really hard to say. I can't say. Yeah, it's hard to say because he's the reason that Jakobsen crashed, and he caused that giant crash and, you know, sent a lot of guys to the hospital. So I think the fairest thing would be maybe to have some kind of suspension, because then you would see, I'm not saying something crazy, but maybe like 2 months, which I understand in this season is a very long time, but in a normal season, 2 months isn't that crazy. And that would maybe make these guys think twice about, you know, making a somewhat sly move in a sprint. So I think that would be a correct penalty, because no one should be sending another person to the hospital. So I guess that's my two cents. I know that's not a very strong opinion one way or the other, but I just think while he didn't, I doubt he had any malintent, as in he didn't want anyone to crash, but he did cause a big crash. So there should be some consequences for his actions. Can we say that he's like the ultimate villain number one in cycling? I wouldn't say that. But yeah, I just really hope that Jakobsen is okay and recovers fine and gets back to normal health, as well as anyone else who was in that crash. So more positive news in the future. But yeah, that's that. And I guess since I'm here, I guess I'll comment on Tour de Lens and Ineos versus Jumbo Visma as well. Watching Tour de Lens, you could see that Jumbo was definitely stronger in the mountains and the stronger team overall. But it is still a few weeks from the Tour. And I know Ineos, they're always 110% for the Tour. So I would say Jumbo would have had some incentive to come into this race stronger than normal. Yeah, show what they're made of and deal the first blow to Ineos. I would say knowing the Ineos guys is right now it's just training and doing everything to be 100% for the tour. And I bet they'll be at least 10% better when it comes to the Tour de France. So I think we'll see a really good battle in September. I definitely don't think by any means it's over.
So that was Larry Warbass. He's back racing. He's in AG2R's Italian bubble. You didn't mention earlier, Lionel, but a bit of news today about AG2R. Roman Bardet's departure is confirmed. He's joining Team Sunweb on a 2-year deal. And Greg Van Avermaet and Michael Schaar both joining AG2R from CCC. They're best buddies, aren't they, Schaar and Van Avermaet? They're very good friends. It looks like AG2R really beefing up their classics team. Oliver Nassen will be there, of course, and quite a Belgian contingent, AG2R. So maybe that's a direction that they're going in. They'll be AG2R Citroën next year. Tour of Poland. Larry spoke a little bit there about the awful crash. Fabio Jakobsen went down end of stage one when he clashed with Dylan Groenewegen. I mean, he was coming up on the right of Groenewegen as Groenewegen was leading out the sprint. And Groenewegen closed the door on him. You know, the elbow came out a little bit. We've seen it hundreds of thousands of times in bunch sprints. Jakobsen on this occasion came down very heavily and at great speed. I mean, it's a downhill finish, quite dangerous in itself, perhaps. And he went straight through the barriers like they were made of confetti paper and suffered horrific injuries. It was a horrendous crash. I saw it once. I didn't really want to watch it again, having seen it. It was awful. And the initial news was terrifying about Jakobsen. He was in an induced coma for a couple of days and had a 5-hour operation on his face. He broke every bone in his face. He lost all his teeth. And the road to recovery for him will be long and tough. And we just await more news, really, on his recovery. And Dylan Groenewegen, well, he broke his collarbone when he came off in the same incident. And he gave quite a tearful interview to Dutch television about how the crash had affected him as well. He's been suspended by his team, a pretty meaningless suspension, given that he's broken his collarbone anyway. But he clearly has been painted as the villain of the piece. And yet, as I say, we have seen maneuvers like that, far more dangerous ones, in bunch sprints many times. And I watched the final stage of the Tour of Poland. It was won by another De Koenig Quickstep sprinter, Davide Ballerini. And he went through a pretty small gap, took risks in doing so. And that's what sprinters do. There's been a lot of discussion about the role of the organisers and the UCI in, I suppose, protecting riders from themselves and making finishes as safe or as not as dangerous as they could be. But I don't know, what are your guys' thoughts on what happened in Poland?
Well, I think the most shocking thing was the way the barriers gave way. When Jakobsen went into the barriers, suddenly a barrier, at least one barrier, was flying into the course of the other riders, causing more danger. I mean, Richard, we were, before we started recording, you talked about, you know, if there's a crash at that speed in a sprint finish, the riders are going to sustain injuries. The bikes are in the way. You know, the tarmac is hard. The job of the race organisers and is to provide as safe a finish as is possible to provide, and the job of the UCI is to ensure that its regulations are first of all fit for purpose and are giving the framework and infrastructure that gives the riders the best chance of avoiding the most serious injuries. And it's highly irregular to see the barriers give way like that, and for Jakobsen to be on the wrong side of the barrier colliding with somebody taking a photograph. And you know, that was the most shocking aspect of it for me. Blaming a rider for a manoeuvre, a dangerous manoeuvre, is one thing, but you do have to kind of separate the action from the consequences. The action, possibly, I mean, I'm speculating here and I don't know, but if it had just been a kind of a regular crash and Groenewegen across the line first, you know, would the race jury have disqualified him for that move that squeezed Jakobsen into the barriers. My suspicion is they probably would have done, because the rules are clear. You're not allowed to deviate from your line. It was very close to the line. On the flip side, Jakobsen is, as you say, Richard, trying to go through a gap that possibly wasn't there. That's the racing aspect of it, and that's for the race jury to decide. The bit that where it gets complicated for me is that the barriers just collapse like cardboard boxes, and that really shouldn't have happened. I contacted the UCI and asked them. I wanted to get somebody on to talk about the type of barriers or what protocols are in place to ensure that the finish of a race, a World Tour race, meets a certain standard. They declined to talk on the record because they say the disciplinary commission is still looking into the incident. But the UCI did point me in the direction of a couple of rules, one of which says the organiser shall take whatever safety measures caution demands. And the other says the organiser shall always strive to attain the best quality of organisation possible with the means at his disposal. And I just think reading those, that those rules need to be tightened up and made less ambiguous. And perhaps that it is the time now for a global standard of barriering at the finish of these races. And some, I know that the UCI has taken action, for example, against the Binkbank Tour last year after a number of incidents. And they've taken action against the race and threatened them with not being included as part of the World Tour unless they basically put on courses that were safe for the riders. But it does feel a little bit like the regulations need to tighten up in order to ensure that there's some kind of universal standard, so that if you're racing at the Tour de France, or if you're racing at the Tour of Poland, or if you're racing at Milan-San Remo, the type of material used is the same. I know they have a regulation about how far along the course the barriers have to go, but in this case I'm talking about the types of barriers, and we've all seen these barriers close up, and they do vary. I would say that the Tour de France ones that kind of interlock and hold together, this is probably speculation that I shouldn't engage in, but I can't imagine. And when you think back to the crash between Cavendish and Peter Sagan a few years ago, similar type of incident, but all the riders stayed within the barriers, and the barriers did their job, which was to not collapse under pressure.
Yeah, we all remember that crash, napalm, and there have been a few incidents over the years that have been similar. It made me, I immediately thought back to, 94 Vuelta, when Mario Cipollini had a terrible crash, and on that occasion it was actually his teammate, Adriano Baffi, who put him into the barriers, very similar actually to the Jakobsen-Groenewegen incident, although on that occasion Cipollini wasn't wearing a helmet, probably quite lucky to survive that crash. But it's just slightly disappointing, isn't it, that there are all sorts of grievances that get raised and pointed out, things that get pointed out, but it's after the event. It takes something like this to happen. We heard from numerous riders afterwards that this is a finish that they've not thought was safe, or that they've been nervous about for a few years. It's a finish that has been done regularly in the Tour of Poland. I think the Tour of Poland has even played on the fact and advertised the fact that this is the fastest finish in World Tour cycling or in elite cycling. Pascal Ackermann a couple of years ago claimed that he'd registered a top speed of 105 kilometers an hour on this finishing straight. His Strava data suggested it wasn't quite that fast, but it was still 85 kilometers an hour. It is downhill. It's incredibly fast. Is it too fast? Well, the best people to answer that question are the riders, and unfortunately, the best platform and the most effective way for riders to raise this kind of grievance remains probably social media or giving interviews before a race happens. It seems to me that I imagine a scenario where 2 days before that finish, two or three riders had taken to Twitter and said, it's ridiculous that we're having to do the Katowice finish again, it's not safe, then I can imagine something might have happened.
What I sort of struggle with is the point of a downhill finish like this. I remember Hein Verbruggen in the 90s or early 2000s almost sort of defending EPO by arguing almost there were market forces at play, that people wanted to see riders riding that quickly up mountains, and I don't think they ever did, and I don't think the public generally particularly want to see sprinters going 10-20 kilometers per hour quicker. I don't really understand what the appeal of that spectacle is. I mean, a downhill fast sprint to me is not as enjoyable as a sprint on a flat bit of road or slightly uphill. That slightly uphill is even better. It will reward a certain kind of rider. There will be riders who will be better at that super fast kind of finish, but I think the risks are too great really to continue to indulge that.
Can you tell the difference between when you're watching on TV, can you tell the difference between 60 and 80k an hour? I don't think you can you? I mean
maybe from the overhead shots, from the helicopter shots after the finish, the action replays. I mean, if you go back and watch that 2018 sprint, that Ackermann sprint, where he claimed to have gone at 105 kilometers an hour, it is very spectacular. From you're in awe of the bike handling skills, but it's a small difference with this one in particular. It's a big city, it's a big place, Katowice. Presumably there are lots of different places where you could have the finish. You know, there are sometimes there are circumstances in smaller races, you know, like the Dauphiné starts tomorrow, and the bid to host a finish is won by a very small place, and they want the race to finish, you know, on the main street, or there aren't that many options for a finish line. In a place like that, I would imagine there would be many options, which is another thing that slightly flummoxed me.
You made a very good point, Daniel, about the riders saying in advance, look, we're not happy with this finish. But at the moment, especially, you know, having had no racing for months, you know, pressure on everybody in the sport to get results, to be visible, to, you know, it would be really extraordinary. It would take extraordinary strength for the riders themselves to say, do you know what, we're not going to do stage one of the Tour of Poland and roll across the finish line in protest. Or first of all, it would take a weight of opinion in favour of taking that sort of action. I thought it was interesting that Gianni Bugno of the Riders Union, the CPA, he kind of pushes the responsibility towards the teams and says, I ask myself, why do the teams not intervene to avoid the risky situations, since they see the routes in advance and can avoid letting their employees take the start if they believe that the safety conditions are not sufficient. It's one of these ones where everyone bears some responsibility, but the ultimate responsibility has to be with the UCI. And as you said, it takes an incident like this for action to be taken.
And I go back to that point about the riders being protected from themselves. I don't think it is the riders' responsibility. I thought that was a reasonable point by Bugno, that the teams, they have far more kind of influence and say. Obviously, there are many collectives of riders. But, you know, for a World Tour race, there should be a minimum standard of safety. And I think, you know, perhaps in any review of this, they will look at downhill finishes, but also barriers and other aspects that make it. It's always going to be dangerous. You know, sprinting is always going to be dangerous. There are always going to be terrible crashes and awful injuries. But when you can look at it and say, well, this was made worse by the fact that it was a very fast downhill sprint and by the barrier, in that context, it's very unfair to put the blame squarely on the shoulders of Dylan Groenewegen. I mean, it seems like he's a very convenient scapegoat in this in some respects.
Well, it avoids the issue, doesn't it, if you blame the rider for the action, ignoring the fact that the action was again, it's a borderline one. Would he or wouldn't he have been disqualified from that result had everyone stayed upright? I suspect he probably would have done, but I couldn't say for certain. Just back on Bugno, he does make the point that the Association of Sports Groups, which is basically the teams, unlike us, meaning the riders, has members within the UCI's Road Commission, and they can vote to change the safety regulations. We can no longer entrust the safety of the athletes to the good luck or hope that the organiser will act correctly. Strict rules and even stricter controls are needed. And that probably is about the sum of it.
Well, I'm sure we'll return to this topic. But how about the race itself? I mean, Remco Evenepoel, first World Tour stage win, but he's won every stage race that he started this season. And he demolished a pretty high quality field. You know, Jakob Fuglsang, Simon Yates, second and third. Minute 52, 2.5 minutes behind him at the end of a 1 week stage race. It's pretty remarkable. That was, we keep saying it, every performance, every win is the most remarkable one yet. And you know, it's you have to remind yourself how young he still is.
Yeah, it's already becoming clear, isn't it, chaps? So we're going to, well, we are already sort of scrambling for superlatives, and that will probably continue to be the case. I mean, we've never seen anything like this. When he was winning, I remember he won the European Junior Road Race by 10 minutes. That seemed unprecedented. Well, it was unprecedented, and you thought then that, well, it's junior racing, maybe, you know, this guy's just a lot more developed than everyone else. And then to skip the under 23 category altogether, and then to start really producing similar kinds of performances in the pro ranks within a year, you know, it's not that long ago that people were debating whether it was irresponsible for De Koenig to let him turn professional. He'd be sort of chewed up and spat out, and you know, he would be burnt out and he wouldn't cut it in the top level. There was a good piece written by a colleague of ours at the weekend, who we featured in our Giro coverage, actually, Leonardo Piccione. He's a young Italian writer, and he wrote a good piece about this conflict, which I think we discussed a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about Evenepoel, where you sort of caught between thinking it's fantastic when this sort of era-defining talent emerges on the scene, and you know, it's something you want to celebrate and you want to enjoy, but then on the other hand, maybe there's a boredom that can kick in quite quickly. There's part of you that wants races to be competitive and you know, doesn't want to see a procession every time this particular rider is on the start line. And Leonardo talked about how, well, in Italian, when you talk about someone being pitch perfect, having like a perfect ear, literally you say they've got an absolute ear. And Leonardo said, we found in Evenepoel, it's almost as though we found someone with the absolute leg. He's got... he's a rider with pitch perfect legs. It's quite something to witness, isn't it?
Well, it's in the genes, isn't it, with Remco, because his dad won the Grand Prix de Wallonie in 1993. His dad Patrick. How did this escape me? How long ago did you know this, Daniel? That his dad had been a pro for the Kolstrop team in the early 90s.
I mean, it's something that's been mentioned in the Belgian press. I mean, I said we're going to be scrambling for superlatives, and it's going to be difficult for us to say something original about Evenepoel, but, you know, spare a thought for our Belgian colleagues who, you know,
they've only got 15 pages Evenepoel news a day to fill, haven't
exactly.
They?
Great little bit of trivia is that Remco Evenepoel's father, Patrick, and Mathieu van der Poel's father, Adri, were briefly teammates on that Kolstrop team in 1994. And it just makes me think, over the winter, could we have a fathers and sons Madison race on the track in Ghent or something? I don't know. Just or a two-up time trial, fathers and sons. I assume it would be Remco on the front, Patrick trying to sit on the wheel.
Good luck, Patrick, with that. He's going to the Giro. We'll be talking about him as one of the favourites for the Giro, despite the fact he's never ridden a three-week race. It's going to be fascinating to see how he gets on there. And you can imagine him going to the Tour de France next year, I think, can't you? I mean, the challenge for De Koenig Quickstep becomes, how do you manage that? How do you keep him? How do you, you know, Patrick Lefebvre has always struggled to find the budget to run his team. It's not it's the most winning team, but not the one with the biggest budget. I can imagine, though, that in Belgium, sponsors will materialise, won't they, in response to Evenepoel. And, you know, Wout van Aert as well, another Belgian. The two kind of flag bearers of the sport at the moment are both Belgian. And, yeah, it was kind of odd watching the Tour de Lan and the big hitters go at it there, while across in Poland there's this just phenomenal talent who's been kind of kept back, held back as much as you can. But I can see him going to the Tour de France as early as next year, I think. A word for, I mentioned Matthew Jorgensen earlier, and rode really well at Milan-San Remo, another young American. We had Jorgensen on the podcast earlier this year. We also had Quinn Simmons on the podcast, who rides for Trek Segafredo, and he rode really well in Poland. He's only 19. He does look late 20s. He's got a big beard and he looks very mature, but he rode very well in Poland as well. So two young Americans there doing extremely well as well, but all of them, of course, in the shadow of Remco Evenepoel.
Rich, you mentioned the Giro and old Remco doing the Giro, but of course he's got to win in Lombardia and Tirreno before that. and before he gets to the Giro.
Well, he's got to win Tirreno, hasn't he, to maintain that record. I mean, the wheels will fall off if he doesn't.
But you would almost be surprised at this point if he didn't win. I mean, Lombardy is it's a perfect race for him. It's long for, you would think, for a young rider. It might be a little bit long, but we saw what he could do in a hilly, difficult one-day race at San Sebastian last year. And Tirreno with a... Well, Tirreno actually doesn't have a time trial this year, does it? Or it doesn't have the usually decisive final time trial. But again, it's already almost difficult to imagine someone beating Evenepoel in those races.
Last word on Remco. Can I just say it was only the Tour of Poland? Let's not get carried away.
Correction. Tirreno does have the final time trial, San Benedetto, according to Pro Cycling Stats, but I think it was taken out anyway.
Any other loose ends from the Tour of Poland? Mark Cavendish in the sprints. He looked there or thereabouts a couple of times. The stage win by Mads Pedersen, which was a big surprise, really, to see Pedersen win a bunch sprint like that, but that was impressive. Cavendish looked to be in a reasonable position, but faded. And on the final stage two, he seemed to be there and then not there.
We keep hoping that we're going to see him competing for one of these stage wins, a sprint stage win, and it hasn't quite happened so far. And there were signs of progress, I think, in Poland. There was that day you mentioned, Rich, when Mads Pedersen won, where he was in a good position with about 300 metres to go, but couldn't quite find the right gap or didn't quite have the legs to bring it home. But, you know, it's no secret, it's been a tough couple of years for Cavendish. I spoke to him 10 days or so ago, and we talked about the Tour de France, and at that point, it hadn't really been decided whether he was going to go to the Tour de France. I still don't think it's official. Well, it hasn't been officially decided. What was clear is that if he did go to the Tour, he wasn't going to get much help because Bahrain or McLaren Bahrain have other fish to fry there with Mikael Landa and the general classification. But it's going to be an interesting few weeks for Cavendish. I think the question of whether he is riding next year, from his point of view, is to a certain extent still up in the air, I think. And I think he's waiting to see how he gets on, because he trained a lot and he trained well. I think he hadn't been home for about 7 weeks before the Vuelta a Burgos. He'd done training camps in Germany, in France. And he's certainly put the hours and the kilometres in, but it hasn't quite happened for him yet.
See, Ivan Garcia Cortina is leaving Barry McLaren to join Movistar next year. That makes a lot of sense for Movistar, I think, that move. He's a big talent. It hasn't quite worked for Cavendish so far this year.
Just a quick plug for Mitch Docker's Life in the Peloton episode, which will be out on Wednesday evening this week, UK time. He's made an audio diary of his return to racing from Strada Bianca through to Milan-San Remo, a sort of Italian road trip. Our producer, Will Jones, is putting that together as we speak. So looking forward to listening to the first edit of that, and that will be out on Wednesday. I think, really interested to see what sort of diary Mitch has put together.
Excellent. Look forward to that. We'll be back next week. We'll have some reaction from you, Daniel, from the Critérium du Dauphiné. Good luck there in France. Are you planning to come back to the UK then after...
At the moment, for a few days, and then off to the Tour de France, but it depends on, government restrictions and...
Decision on Thursday, apparently, on that.
And testing. I had my first coronavirus test on Saturday.
How was that?
Not nearly as bad as I expected it to be. I thought it was going to be like a fairly invasive nasoscopy, which I had a couple of years ago, but no, it wasn't anything like that at all.
Negative?
I'm waiting for the result.
Oh, okay, watch this space.
On tenterhooks. It'd be the first positive test for the cycling podcast if it goes wrong, Daniel. And, well, one strike and you're out.
We've had a few peddlers to charm fall foul of the over the years, so, but we gloss over that a little bit. Anyway, just before we go, a few thank yous to friends of the podcast. Thanks to everybody who signed up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. And for me, special thanks to John Green. John, you tweeted us requesting that we give you a thank you on the podcast. Don't normally respond to requests, but yours was quite charming. So thank you to you, to Andrew Gifford, Ron Richman, Tony Brandon, Pike Talbert, and David Cockings.
And thanks from me to James Horn, Padre O'Shea, Andrew Watson, Doncha Redmond, Stephen McDade, and Steve Dennis.
And thank you to Simon Brook, Andrew Berry, Jules Christmas, Richard Robinson, Tom Charlesworth, and Jeff Bitting.
We'll be back next week, won't we? That's all for now. Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.